From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, happy birthday to Al Cooper. He turns 60 years old next week. He was a member of the Blues Project and a founder of Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Cooper played the now-famous organ line on Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone. We'll listen back to an interview with him. Also, composer Howard Shore. His work on the film The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King has just won 2 Golden Globes and has been nominated for 2 Academy Awards. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Finding Nemo and The Triplets of Belleville, 2 Academy Award nominees for Best Feature Animated Film. And TV critic David Biancooley pays tribute to Jack Parr, who died this week. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The White House is saying that Medicare reforms passed last year will be far more costly than originally thought, but the president says Congress was not misled when the administration was trying to get the package of bills passed. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The president put the cost of the legislation at $400 billion over 10 years. But now the administration, having analyzed the Congressional Budget Office cost estimate in the final bill, says the actual price tag will be $530 billion. That's an increase of 33%. The president defended the program even at the higher cost.
It's going to require Congress to be wise with the taxpayers' money. Now, the Medicare reform we did is a good reform. Fulfills a longstanding promise to our seniors.
The president said that to keep the deficit from growing further, other cuts will have to be made. He didn't list them. His 2005 budget comes out Monday, with some conservative Republicans already complaining it contains too much red ink. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
The Democratic presidential contenders have been sharply critical of the Medicare prescription drug benefit. Senator John Kerry said it offers little benefit for seniors.
George Bush's Medicare bill, now we know it's more expensive, but even before that, it was a disaster for seniors. It's not a legitimate Medicare prescription drug benefit. It's a benefit for drug companies.
Kerry made his comments in an interview on NPR's Morning Edition. For the first time next week, a U.S. citizen captured in Afghanistan and declared an enemy combatant will be allowed to meet with a lawyer. Yasser Esam Hamdi has been held without charges for more than 2 years. He's now being held at a Navy brig in South Carolina. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
The meeting comes 2 months after the Pentagon reversed its stance and decided to allow Hamdi counsel. Public defender Frank Dunham complains that military personnel will sit in on the meeting set for Tuesday. And though they'll be sworn to secrecy, Dunham says he'll be guarded in what he says and what he allows Hamdi to say. The Bush administration has defended Hamdi's long isolation, saying outside contacts would intrude in its interrogation of him. Civil rights groups charge the indefinite detention is unconstitutional, and the Supreme Court has said it will take up the case. Lawyer Dunham jokes that he may take Hamdi a voter registration card in case he wants to cast a ballot in Tuesday's South Carolina primary. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
Israeli troops entered the West Bank town of Bethlehem today and demolished the home of the Palestinian suicide bomber responsible for yesterday's bus bombing in Jerusalem. The bombing killed 10 Israelis. In stocks, the Dow lost 22 to close at 10,488. The Nasdaq was down 2 to 2066. This is NPR News. In Colorado, testimony in an ongoing trial has revealed that officials at the University of Colorado at Boulder may have used sex parties to recruit football players. University athletics officials deny the allegations, but the state's governor is taking the complaint seriously. NPR's Jeff Brady reports.
In the civil trial, a student claimed she was raped by football players in 2001. Boulder District Attorney Mary Keenan testified the university created a hostile environment for women by promising sex to football recruits. Keenan says she discovered the problem while investigating several rape allegations at the school. A campus police officer's testimony backed up the prosecutor's claims. Timothy Delaria said a recruit told him that sex parties were a fringe benefit of coming to Colorado. Football coach Gary Barnett, in a written statement, called the allegations allegations a lie. Nonetheless, Colorado Governor Bill Owens wrote a strongly worded letter to the university demanding a public accounting of the allegations. Owens told university officials, "Women are not recruiting tools." The school's regents are scheduled to meet in coming days to discuss the allegations. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Denver.
The police brutality trial of a Los Angeles officer has ended in a hung jury. It's the second time that a jury has been unable to reach a verdict in the case of Officer Jeremy Morse, who's accused of unnecessary violence against a black teenager during an arrest in July of 2002. Morse is white, prompting allegations that his behavior was triggered by racism. The case gained nationwide attention because the arrest was videotaped by a bystander. It showed Morse slamming the teenager to the trunk of a police car and punching him in the face. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Focus Features and Universal Home Video, presenting Lost in Translation, starring Bill Murray, coming to DVD February 3rd.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Musician, composer, and producer Al Cooper turned 60 on Thursday. He hasn't performed in public much in the last several years due to health problems, but he'll be back on stage tomorrow night for a 60th birthday celebration at the Berklee Performance Center in Boston, and on Wednesday for another birthday appearance at Joe's Pub in New York. And he's at work producing a box set reissue of music by the late guitarist Mike Bloomfield. In 1965, Cooper co-founded the Blues Project. A couple years later, he formed the band Blood, Sweat, and Tears and wrote most of their early songs. He played on Bob Dylan's albums Blonde on Blonde and Highway 61 Revisited and played the famous organ line on Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone. He's also played on recordings by the Rolling Stones, Jimi Hendrix, and George Harrison, and produced records by Lynyrd Skynyrd, Nils Lofgren, and Rick Nelson. He started his career when he was still a teenager. His memoir, Backstage Passes and Backstabbing Bastards, is filled with interesting behind-the-scenes stories about pop and rock in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Terry Gross spoke to Al Cooper in 1998.
Your big pop success as a songwriter was This Diamond Ring, which was recorded by Gary Lewis and the Playboys, Gary being Jerry Lewis's son. And you say in your memoir that you wrote that song with an R&B group like the Drifters in mind. So how did it end up being performed by Gary Lewis instead of the Drifters?
Boy, it beats the hell out of me. I was amazed. My publisher at the time, Aaron Schroeder, saw me in the hallway and he said, well, we got a record on that Drifter song you wrote. I said, oh, the Drifters cut it? He said, no. Snuff Garrett cut it. Snuff Garrett was a West Coast producer known for producing Bobby V and people like that. And I said, since when is Snuff Garrett cutting R&B records? He said, well, he's not. I said, oh, dear. He said, well, I have the record. Do you want to come upstairs and hear it? I said, well, just out of curiosity, I'd like to hear what Snuff Garrett did with This Diamond Ring. And so I went upstairs and he played the record and I was just heartsick. I thought it was terrible. I admonished him after he played the record and said, you know, I don't even waste my time playing me things like this again. That's the worst thing I ever heard.
Of course, it became a huge hit.
Yeah, 2 months later, it was number one in the country. And I say, hey, I wrote that song.
Now, what do you think about the arrangement now?
Oh, I still hate it. I still think it's an insipid, horrible record. And as a matter of fact, I went in later years and at much expense to my credibility, recorded the song on one of my solo albums to show people where it came from and what it was like, because I actually think it's a good song. I just couldn't stand the Gary Lewis interpretation.
Okay, we're going to hear both of those versions back to back. We're going to hear the Gary Lewis version and then the version that you cut with the arrangement that you originally had in mind, the version you cut in the 1970s. So here
you know,
we go.
It's even... Yeah. It's even funnier if you play it the other way around. If you play mine first and then play Gary Lewis's, which is, you know, the way I saw it, it's even funnier that way.
I'm willing to give that a shot. Is our engineer
okay.
ready to do that? Our engineer's ready to do that? Let's go. So this is Al Cooper followed by Gary Lewis's version of Al Cooper's song, This Diamond Ring. ¶¶
Who wants to buy this diamond ring? She took it off her finger now. It don't mean a thing. No. This diamond ring don't shine for me anymore. This diamond ring don't mean what it did before. So if you've got some buddy whose love is true, won't you let it shine for you now?
Okay, Al Cooper, guess what? I like the Gary Lewis version. I'm not saying I don't like yours, but I like the Gary Lewis version. I think it's a fun pop hit.
Well, so did many millions of people.
Is the interview over now?
It's a sad thing.
You don't like that kind of like kettle drum or whatever is on there?
Timpani, no. Timpani, it's great in, certain things. It was great in the 1812 Overture.
So what did the Gary Lewis version do for your career? Did it help it a lot?
Yeah, it helped it tremendously as a songwriter. Right after that, we had another top 20 record by Gene Pitney called I Must Be Seeing Things. And
want to sing a few bars of that to refresh our memory?
Well, I'll recite the opening lyrics. I used to write the music, and I wrote with two other guys, and they wrote the words, as I was sort of lyrically deficient at the time. And this one, typical of its time, said, "Isn't that my girl? And is that my best friend? Aren't they walking much too close together? And it don't look like they're talking about the weather." And then it goes, "Hey, I must be seeing things. This can't be." Like that. That was typical of the songs we wrote at that time.
Well, in the 1960s, you met Bob Dylan through Dylan's record producer of the time, Tom Wilson, and this was in what year, about?
1965.
65. And Tom Wilson had just cut Dylan's first electric single, Subterranean Homesick Blues, and he invited you to watch Dylan at a session, and you were determined, you say, to do more than watch. You wanted to actually play on it. The session turned out to be the session for Highway 61 Revisited, in which Like a Rolling Stone was recorded, and you played Hammond B3 on Like a Rolling Stone. How did you get to play on it?
Well, I was just determined to play. I was a guitar player at the time, and I stayed up all night practicing, and had an inflated opinion of my ability as a guitar player. And I got to the session, and at the time I was playing guitar on records as a session musician, so the other musicians that were there early when I got there did not think it was unusual for me to be there with my guitar, because I'd played sessions with them, and they knew that I did session work. And I set up my stuff, and I sat down, and I waited, and Dylan came in with a guitar player who was roughly my age, and he sat down and started warming up, and I realized I was in way over my head. He was the best guitar player I'd ever heard in my life, just warming up. Just the things he was playing were way beyond my grasp as a player, and I said to myself, I got to get out of here before I really embarrass myself. So when there was a moment, I took my guitar and put it in the case and put it against the wall, and I went in the control room where I belonged and watched the session. And Tom Wilson came in, and he hadn't seen me sitting out there with the guitar, so that was very good. And then during the session, they had someone playing the organ, and they moved him over to a piano. Actually, his name was Paul Griffin. He was a studio keyboard player. And I walked over to Tom Wilson. I said, "Hey, why don't you let me play organ on this? I got a great part for this." He went, "Oh man, you're not a organ player. You're a guitar player. You don't play the organ." And I said, "Oh yeah, I got a great part for this, Tom." And at just at that point, they called him for a phone call. And I thought to myself, well, he didn't say no. He just said I wasn't an organ player. And so I went out and sat down at the organ. And as a matter of fact, if Paul Griffin hadn't have left the organ switched on, that would have been the end of my career, because it's very complicated to turn on a Hammond B3 organ. It takes about three separate moves, and you have to know what you're doing. And I didn't. But it was on already, so I was saved. And then Tom Wilson came back out, and he said, "Okay, this is take six." And then he saw me, and he said, "Hey, what are you doing out there?" And I just started laughing. And he was a gentleman. He just said, okay, let's go. We're rolling. This is take seven. I guess he thought, you know, if I wanted to do this so bad, he would stand behind it because he was my friend.
When you had told Tom Wilson that you had a part worked out in your head, did you really?
No, of course not. 90% ambition.
Okay, so then what happened? They start performing the song.
Well, they were rehearsing for a second, and I kind of got the thing. The speaker to the organ was very far from where I was sitting at the organ, and it was covered by baffling so that it wouldn't leak into other microphones that were on in the studio. And so I couldn't actually hear what I was playing. And I didn't have any music to read. I had to do it by ear, which I was used to doing because of playing on sessions as a guitar player. And I just kind of, you know, muddled my way through it, and it was the only complete take of the day. So they went in to play it back and listen to it. And during the playback, Dylan went over to Tom Wilson and said, "Hey, turn the organ up." And he said, "Oh man, that guy's not an organ player." He says, "I don't care, turn the organ up." And that's how I became an organ player.
Well, let's hear Like a Rolling Stone with my guest Al Cooper featured on organ.
Once upon a time, you dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you, people call, say beware doll, you're bound to fall. You thought they were all kidding you. About everybody that was hanging out. Now you don't talk so loud. Now you don't seem so proud about having to be scrounging your next.
My guest Al Cooper featured on organ. Now, in your memoir, you write that you used to take records that were people, like bands copying what they heard on Dylan records and play them for Dylan, and that would be really amusing. So I brought in one for you to hear. I don't know if you know this one or not, but this is one that I think is really so inspired by Like a Rolling Stone and has an kind of cheesy organ or electric piano, I'm not sure which it is, that seems to be inspired by your part. So let me play it for you and see what you think.
Some words are best not spoken, some things are best
that's not sad. But since this is your public execution, I think I'm gonna go right on ahead. Mailman brought your letter, babe, where you told me how you feel and about the things he said he told you, and how it is I'm such a heel. But I could never be honest that to you I'd always lied, but he saw me take some other hide for a two-wheel pony ride.
Okay, that was a song.
Don't tell me what it was, because I'm going to tell you what it was.
Oh, good, okay. Go ahead.
That was Mouse in the Traps with A Public Execution.
Correct, and it's one of the records on that great anthology, Nuggets. A little Woolly Bully action in there, too, I think.
Well, yeah, it is, by the way, a very cheesy organ, probably a Farfisa.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, that was one of the records that we laughed at back then.
So you played that for Dylan when it came out?
Well, as we both used to listen to them, it wasn't, you know, we'd like, I'd go to the record store and then we'd go back to his house and we'd put all these records on and just sit there and laugh.
Musician, composer, and producer Al Cooper speaking with Terry Gross. They'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with musician, composer, and record producer Al Cooper. He told Terry he formed Blood, Sweat, and Tears because he wanted a group that featured horn arrangements. They spoke in 1998.
Why don't we hear I Love You More Than You'll Ever Know, and we'll start this a little deep into it where the horns start to become prominent. This is Blood, Sweat, and Tears. My guest is Al Cooper.
When I wasn't making too much money, where my paycheck went. You know I brought it home to baby, and I never spent one red cent. Is that a way for a man to carry on? You think it won't, his little loved one gone. I love you, more than you'll ever know, more than you'll ever know. Everything that you demand, I could be president of General Motors, baby, or just a tiny little grain of sand. Is that a way for a man to carry on? You think it won't, his little loved one gone. I love you, baby.
Al Cooper, had you worked with horns like this before?
Just there was a period in my life where I wrote ghost arrangements, and and I wrote for horns in that situation. But I had not really been in a band with a horn section, no. I had admired Maynard Ferguson's jazz group, which had a large horn section, and that was sort of my model for Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
You know, you write in your book that aging in pop business is always held against you, that, you know, if you're older, you're seen as not being cutting edge anymore and, you know, therefore washed up.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty accurate portrayal of the music business.
Mm-hmm.
Except maybe, you know, in the blues area where they respect seniority.
That's true. That is really true, yeah. It's true in some rock and roll, too, like, you know, I mean, the Rolling Stones can get as old as whatever.
Oh, yeah. No, there are exceptions to the rule, and there are people that are really fortunate enough to keep going, but there are many that don't. And the other thing is that, you know, take a person like Bob Dylan or Sly and the Family Stone. These are people that made incredible music, and yet the society is geared up and insist that they must continue doing that for the rest of their lives, or they're horrible people, or they're washed up, they're through. But, I mean, if you look at the body of work that Sly and the Family Stone left us, it doesn't matter if he writes another song again. He changed music forever and was an incredibly strong influence on the way music is being played today in the R&B field. Everyone owes a debt to him. And yet, you know, people go, he's through, he's a drug casualty. He is none of those things. He is a strong influence in the history of music.
Al Cooper, I really appreciate your talking with us, and I want to thank you very much.
It was my pleasure.
Musician, composer, and producer Al Cooper speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. Cooper celebrates his 60th birthday next week with performances in Boston and New York. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com, and from Toyota and the next generation Prius, featuring hybrid synergy drive, committed to the quality of the air as well as the airwaves. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, composer Howard Shore. This is music from his score for the film The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, which just won a Golden Globe. Also, David Edelstein reviews Finding Nemo and the Triplets of Belleville, two Academy Award nominees for Best Animated Feature. And David Bean Cooley remembers Jack Parr. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. The leading contenders for this year's Best Animated Feature Academy Award are the Pixar blockbuster Finding Nemo, now on DVD, and a surreal French fantasia called The Triplets of Belleville, which is still opening in theaters across the country. Film critic David Edelstein looks at the contest and the movies.
Oscar voters don't have all that many candidates to nominate for their Best Animated Feature category, but this year they've got two big winners. Movies as good as anything with flesh and blood actors, and in many cases better acted. Finding Nemo and The Triplets of Belleville could hardly be more distinct from each other. One is the triumph of computerized corporate movie making. The other, so bizarrely idiosyncratic that you wonder what on earth you're watching, even while your jaw is on the ground. Finding Nemo deserved to be the smash that it was. From Pixar, you expect astonishingly fluid 3D animation, dazzling dimensional detail, a rollicking pace, and a script packed with patter and in-jokes. What you might not expect is the beauty. It's clear the folks who put the film together, under the direction of Andrew Stanton, became intoxicated by their underwater settings. Every frame contains hundreds of decisions about light and color and movement, and more important, they're inspired decisions. You also expect the usual Disney-ish homilies and characters suitable for fast food tie-ins, but Nemo goes a little deeper. The protagonist, Marlin the Clownfish, voiced by Albert Brooks, is helpless to save his wife and 399 of her eggs from being devoured by a predator. Only one egg, that's Nemo, remains. Marlin becomes the classic overprotective parent, and the upshot is that his kid becomes defiantly reckless and gets himself netted. In the course of Marlin's desperate odyssey to find his son, he picks up a sidekick, a skinny purple fish named Dory, with the voice of Ellen DeGeneres, who suffers from short-term memory loss, and whose interjections are both absurd and weirdly pertinent. Meanwhile, the thrills come, literally, in schools. But Nemo doesn't change the way you see the world, or the culture, or your own body. It doesn't play with your perceptions of space and time, which the greatest animation can. Sylvain Chomet's Triplets of Belleville is the story of the elderly, gnomish Madame Souza, whose grandson is kidnapped from the Tour de France by French wine-swilling gangsters and taken to a distant metropolis across the ocean, and how she and her train-loving pooch fall in with three ancient frog-slurping sisters who used to be nightclub chanteuses, and still are, although the act itself is a surreal ghost of its former self. Actually, that act is pretty surreal to begin with. Here's the opening flashback with the triplets singing their nonsense theme song, which incidentally has also been nominated for an Oscar. I'd wager the first best song nominee to blend 30s French slang with words like caca and poo-poo. This nightclub scene is like a scratchy 30s Max Fleischer cartoon. It features caricatures of Josephine Baker, Django Reinhardt, and Fred Astaire, whose shoes sprout teeth and eat him alive.
Swinging that little rendezvous, my don dancing, dippy-doo. Voodoo, caca, valet à bout. Oh, Belleville swashing all day.
Why is this loosely plotted oddity, both retro and avant-garde, so powerful? In part, it's the old-fashioned 2D animation, with its tension between wiggly and boxy, and its soundtrack inspired by the slapstick lyricism of Jacques Tati. But it's also because Chomet makes you see the solidity and the fleetingness of the world at the same instant. Those aged triplets with their sloping shoulders and bony fingers, they move when the spirit takes them like basketball players. That homuncular grandma with wisps of hair above her lip, there's a fierceness to her spirit that carries her across the Atlantic in a tiny rowboat. Those skeletal bicyclists with huge, rock-hard calves, they keep pedaling even as they're wasting away from exhaustion and despair. Underneath this whimsical, bebop hallucination of 30s nightclubs and gangsters and ocean liners is an ode to the tenacity of the life force, even amid the most grotesque decay. The Triplets of Belleville is in a league of its own. It makes even the undersea miracles of Finding Nemo seem earthbound.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Coming up, film composer Howard Shore. This is Fresh Air. Composer Howard Shore won an Oscar for the score he wrote for the first film in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, The Fellowship of the Ring. Earlier this week, he received two nominations for his music in the third and final film, The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King. And last weekend, he won two Golden Globe Awards for his work on the film, Best Original Score and Best Original Song. Shore has scored more than 60 films, including Seven, The Silence of the Lambs, The Score, and Analyze This. He's had a long collaboration with Canadian film director David Cronenberg and wrote the music for Cronenberg's films Scanners, Videodrome, The Fly, Dead Ringers, Naked Lunch, and Crash. Back in 1975, Shore was one of the founding members of Saturday Night Live. He wrote the show's theme and served as music director until 1980. When Terry spoke with Howard Shore in 2002, she asked him about the music for The Lord of the Rings.
Was there any music that you studied or immersed yourself in to help bring to life a non-existent time in a non-existent place?
Well, Middle Earth is 6,000 to 7,000 years ago, and Peter Jackson didn't want to create a fantasy world. He wanted to create a historical feeling for the story, that in the sense that it, as if it had actually happened. So, all of our work is really based on on making it as real as possible. There wasn't any one particular piece in my research that I looked at that I followed, but the research led me to studying a lot of work that was created before Tolkien wrote Lord of the Rings, and then I studied everything in the last 50 years on how Lord of the Rings affected popular culture in terms of music or literature or cinema. And that actually did lead me in a lot of directions. And once I had absorbed what I felt had been done in this world, I then put it all aside. And, of course, I wanted to feel what was my voice and what would I create and what was the feeling that I was comfortable with as an artist to create in this world.
Now, you did several scores for the Canadian filmmaker David Cronenberg,
yes,
including Scanners, The Fly, Videodrome, M. Butterfly, Naked Lunch, Dead Ringers.
Yes.
How did you meet, and why it's such a long collaboration?
Spider is the last film I just finished with David. That's our 10th film, and it's been over 20 years. But we somewhat grew up making movies. And David's a few years older than me, and I knew him in Toronto, and he was sort of an older kid, and that was very wise, and was making 8mm movies, and then he started making 16mm movies, and I knew about him, and I always thought it would be wonderful to, at a certain point, if I had enough experience, to approach him about doing one of his films. And I finally did in the late 70s, and I worked with him on a film called The Brood, and it was actually the first film that he had worked with a composer and I had worked with a director. So our whole learning process has been growing up together, making movies. I've learned so much from him about how to make movies. He's such an amazing director, and the process just continues.
Let's hear an excerpt of how your music is used in the film Scanners. Scanners is a film about a group of people who have this ability to read other people's minds, to read their thoughts. And you'd think that that would be a good thing, that you'd want to read other people's thoughts, but what happens is that it's so intense to have all these other voices in your head, all these other thoughts and voices from other people, that your head can just literally explode from the pressure of all that information and all those voices inside your head. Now, two brothers who are the best scanners, the best readers of other people's minds, are also, they're each other's arch enemies. And this is like the final contest between them at the end, in which they're both scanning each other's minds and their bodies are kind of like exploding in the process. As we hear this music, their veins are starting to kind of rise above their skin and kind of pop, and their faces are distending and contorting. So let's hear that final scene in the showdown between the two brothers who are scanners.
All right, we're gonna do it the scanner way. I'm gonna suck your brain dry. Everything you are is gonna become me. You're gonna be with me, Cameron, no matter what. After all, brothers should be close, don't you think?
An excerpt from the David Cronenberg movie Scanners. My guest Howard Shore did the music. You know, mixed into that music, we're hearing like other kinds of sound, including what sounds like it might be like the growling of tigers and maybe machinery mixed under that, just to give you the sense of like of the agony of the scene that we're witnessing. What is happening with the music there?
Right. This is a very early film of mine. I think this was maybe the second film that I did. And this is quite an experimental piece using orchestra and using electronics, but pure electronics. These are sounds that I've created through tape manipulation. They're sounds that I had recorded. And by the use of tape, this is pre-computers, pre-synthesizers, this piece. And it was using older tape techniques, music concrete, tape techniques of the 50s. When I was growing up in Toronto, I was interested in a lot of these techniques. And as a kid, I was interested in tape recorders and splicing pieces of sound together. And I heard Toru Takemitsu's, the great Japanese composer, I heard his music very early on when I was 10 and 11. And I was experimenting with these type of techniques quite early on. So working on scanners, I think maybe in my late 20s, I finally had a chance to use some of these techniques with an orchestra and was able to go into a recording studio and try some of these things that I'd been experimenting with for years.
Well, it's really interesting to me how you're able to work all these kind of edgy musics into your scores. Let's listen to an excerpt of your score for Naked Lunch. And this was the David Cronenberg adaptation of the William Burroughs novel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the William Burroughs and his fellow beat writers were very involved with Charlie Parker. Ornette Coleman is much more avant-garde and... very interesting that you managed to use him on the soundtrack for this. Before we hear it, tell us why you wanted to work with Ornette Coleman for the soundtrack.
I had met Ornette Coleman in New York, and I knew that just growing up in the 50s, I mean, I was a huge fan of Ornette's, and I asked him to do the film. The period that he was creating his music in the late 50s and Naked Lunch coincide perfectly. And Ornette, of course, was aware of Burroughs and Burroughs of Ornette. So the expression that Ornette had in music in the late 50s was very similar to what Burroughs was creating on the page. in that same period. So it's like a perfect connection to Burroughs' state of mind in the 50s was to work with Arnett. And he was fascinated with the project and wanted to work on it. And it was a wonderful collaboration, actually.
How did the collaboration work? Because he's playing against a more symphonic piece that you've written. Could you talk about what he's doing and what you've composed behind him?
Right. He's working with me in a very improvisational way. I created a structure and a form for Arnett to express himself in.
Why don't we hear an excerpt of that score? And this is Howard Shore's composition for the soundtrack of Naked Lunch with saxophonist Ornette Coleman. Music from the soundtrack of the film Naked Lunch, composed by my guest Howard Shore, with saxophonist Ornette Coleman improvising within that. What did you tell Ornette Coleman when you asked him to perform on the soundtrack?
We had many, many discussions about the piece. It wasn't so much telling Ornette what to do. It was more working with him as a peer and expressing it was if you were playing with Ornette in his group. And it was a very harmonic process where all parts are equal. So I'm expressing ideas that Ornette is expressing, and then I would express another idea. So we worked together sort of very, very carefully, and, you know, before the recording, in rehearsals with sketches of what I was writing. And then the sessions were done in a very open, creative, free way.
Composer Howard Shore speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. His work on the third Lord of the Rings film, The Return of the King, has won 2 Golden Globe Awards and earned 2 Oscar nominations. Coming up, David Bean Cooley remembers Jack Parr. This is Fresh Air. Jack Parr died this week, and TV critic David Bean Cooley says fans of quality television and genuine conversation have reason to be very sad, even though he retired from the medium more than 40 years ago.
I teach a college course in TV history and appreciation, and the longer I teach it, the more I have to teach because the students keep getting younger. Actually, they're just born later, but their frame of reference keeps getting narrower. College students who are 20 now and who really started absorbing mature mass media less than a decade ago have a lot of ground to make up. For them, nostalgia is Saved by the Bell, and they've never known a TV world without cable. Fewer of them each year have seen a single complete episode of The Honeymooners. Most of them, by now, haven't even seen a single frame of Twin Peaks. And to them, the only host of The Tonight Show they've ever seen and known is Jay Leno. But in the history of television, late-night TV in particular, Jack Parr was something truly special. NBC's Tonight Show began 50 years ago, with Steve Allen as the pioneering host. Allen's tenure lasted for 3 years. He told jokes, joked around with his very funny gang of supporting comics, interviewed and showcased a wide range of talented guests, played piano, and played with the medium of TV itself. Jack Parr, except for the piano playing and TV trickery, did the same sort of thing, but he did it very differently. Jack Parr's Tonight Show, which lasted from 1957 to 1962, treasured talent and conversation above all else. If you can imagine this, guests were discouraged from plugging their current films or projects. Parr just wanted people to come on and perform, and then he wanted to sit down with them and talk. It was Parr who established the format of desk and couch, which pretty much has been the standard ever since. But Parr also presented a freewheeling, unpredictable type of television that all these years later remains singularly rare. Parr didn't write his monologues or prepare his introductions. He just talked. For the first few years of The Tonight Show, he did all that live, the ultimate high wire act. And the people he was interested in talking to weren't just movie stars. He invited authors and artists and politicians. He went to Cuba to sit down with Fidel Castro. And during the 1960 presidential race, he had both John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon as guests, making separate and equally memorable appearances.
I have noticed that if you watch political programs, they are asked political questions, and the answers are political answers. And sometimes, I must say, I watch shows for a half hour, and when it's all over, no one said anything when it's all over. But there is a chance that in this relaxed atmosphere of The Tonight Show, you can meet people who aren't on guard, not as tense, and perhaps not as political as you would meet them on other news-type shows.
Parr made stars out of such new talents as Bill Cosby, Woody Allen, and the Smothers Brothers. Most of all, though, he's remembered for his spontaneity. No one knew what Jack Parr would say or do next. His personality was high-strung and very sensitive. Even after he began pre-taping the show, Parr was famously unpredictable. In February of 1960, Parr told a joke during his opening monologue that involved a bathroom. The quaint term he used then was WC, or water closet. NBC cut the joke from that evening's broadcast, and the next day, Parr waited until the show began taping, then quit right there on a taped program he knew NBC would have no choice but to air. Parr stayed away for a month, then returned with one of the best punchlines in the history of late-night TV. Here's the way Conan O'Brien set it up in an NBC special from 2001.
There must be a better way of making a living than this. You have been peachy to me always.
When Parr walked out, guest hosts filled in, including a young comic and game show host named Johnny Carson. Finally, NBC and Jack Parr buried the hatchet, and Jack's first night back was national news.
I believe my last words were that there must be a better way of making a living than this. Well, I have looked. And there isn't.
I met Parr long ago, and he was exactly the same in person as he was on the air. That's the simple secret to hosting that kind of television show, but pulling it off is not so simple. Arthur Godfrey had that gift, but also had a sour personality. Tom Snyder had it. Right now on TV, Regis Philbin has it. And when he chooses to, so does David Letterman. None of those current shows, though, embrace pure conversation and true unpredictability the way Jack Parr did. Four decades later, what he accomplished and what he cared about remains just as rare, and you can hear his gift for smooth but casual speech even in his farewell appearance from 1962.
It's time to leave you now. I've never thought of myself as a complex personality, but sometimes it turned out that way. And now, even in leaving, it's ironic that I say goodbye, only to be followed by 10 repeat programs this summer. I find it harder to get off television than it was to get on it. Randy keeps referring to this as my sabbatical. And I keep telling her if she uses words like that to her father, he's not going to go on paying to send her to school. But I looked it up, and I find that though it means any rest period, it comes from the ancient Hebrew and originally meant every seventh year during which the fields were left untilled. You know, you can only work a field so many seasons in a row before it becomes barren. Then you must let it lie fallow for a time so the soil becomes fertile and new growth can take root. I don't think Parr's half acre is completely worn out, but it's gotten a little dry lately. And no wonder my sabbatical is 2 years overdue. There are great opportunities for new talent in television. I know from my own beginnings in radio how important that first break can be. And I've tried to offer such a beginning to new performers on this program. In a sense, that's what I'm doing now, too. Having run out of fresh, exciting, new ideas to bring you myself, I feel I should give somebody else a turn.
Jack Parr was brilliant. He was even smart enough to predict that someone else big might come along to till his field. Parr's replacement on The Tonight Show was Johnny Carson, who hosted the program for the next 30 years. He's another guy I have to teach my students about these days. But believe me, it's my pleasure.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chellug, and Jessica Chu. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, a financial services company serving nearly 3 million members. Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, where values thrive. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, David Denby, staff writer and film critic for The New Yorker. When his wife announced she was leaving him in the year 2000, he plunged into an obsession with the stock market at the height of the market's irrational exuberance. It's the subject of Denby's new memoir, American Sucker. Join us for the next Fresh Air.